Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a timely free resource with you. When you look at the headlines, war, instability, constant talk about the end times, it's easy to feel anxious or unsure what to think. But the Bible offers a better way. Our short guide, Watchful, Not Worried, End Times, the Second Coming, and How to Read the News with Biblical Hope, will help you understand what Scripture really says about the end times, so you can live with clarity, hope, and confidence instead of fear. You'll discover how to read the news through the lens of Scripture, avoid speculation, and stay grounded in God's bigger story. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really pleased to have a guest on the show today, returning for, I think, his second appearance on the show. It's Dr. Daniel Morn. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Tim.
Great to have you back on the show. Thanks so much for coming on. You very kindly came on and talked to us, what was it, about a year and a half ago, maybe something like that, about your work as a psychiatrist. Do you want to just briefly introduce yourself for anyone who didn't listen to that episode, who you are, what do you do, that kind of thing?
Sure. Yeah, my name is Daniel Morn. I'm a psychiatrist working in Oxford. I work in a psychosis service, but within that service, I also see the full range of mental health problems, and particularly pertinent to this podcast, I regularly assess and treat people with ADHD. I really enjoy my work, and although it's challenging, we see real change. And I think one of the big false beliefs about psychiatry or mental health is that you don't see change. You really, really do. And I love supporting people to, you know, rebuild their lives again and find their sense of self after really difficult periods in their life.
Brilliant. Well, as Daniel has mentioned, he's given it away. The topic for today we wanted to talk about was ADHD. And this was kind of prompted by a question from a listener called Karen, who emailed in a few weeks ago to say this. As a teacher at a Sydney high school, I've seen a blowout in the number of teenagers on Ritalin and other ADHD drugs. It would be great to do a podcast on this phenomenon and whether it's ethical for Christians to take these drugs, which are often an artificial aid for trying to stay on task and focus well. And we thought this was a really fascinating question and topic. So thanks, Karen, for sending it in. But before we get to the kind of ethics at the end of it, let's first just kind of lay some groundwork. Daniel, can you tell us what is ADHD? What does it stand for? What does it mean? How is it diagnosed?
Thanks, Tim. ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. This is a concept or a sort of a diagnosis or neurodevelopmental condition that has been around for decades now. And yes, it has been growing in its prevalence, its frequency of diagnosis. At its core, ADHD is a very biological problem. It is a problem located in the reward center in your brain. There's a little thing in the midbrain called the nucleus accumbens. This is what governs your reward center. Now, most people think about their reward center as something which, you know, perhaps goes into overdrive when they've climbed Mount Everest or something, but otherwise doesn't really do any job whatsoever. But actually, that's entirely wrong. Your reward center in your brain is working all the time, and it's what helps you focus your attention to anything. So in me speaking to you two today, my reward centers trickling in a little bit of dopamine, because dopamine is the neuro chemical which works in the reward center. And it's telling me to attend to your questions. It's telling me to think clearly about this topic. And so if you think about the reward center as being really the bit of the brain which helps you focus and helps you attend to things, when you think about the ADHD brain, what we know about this is that the reward center is actually underactive. So there's not enough dopamine in this reward center. So what you find is when somebody with ADHD is trying to attend to something, which perhaps isn't that interesting to them, maybe it's an administrative task, maybe it's some household chores, maybe it's somebody giving them a set of instructions, they haven't got the right level of dopamine to really allow their brain, the dopamine is not telling their brain sufficiently well to say, focus on this. So what you find is that the brain looks around, what else can I focus on? And for that reason, people with ADHD, if I had ADHD now, I might be tuning in a bit to you, but I'll also be looking around in the room that I'm in, being distracted by the views outside, the noise from outside the window, because my brain is looking for more stimulus. Whereas if I didn't have ADHD, the dopamine levels in my reward centers would be functioning at a good level and allowing me to attend to things. What you find in the end, the ADHD brain, is that for things they're really interested in, for example, for me, it might be, you know, looking at a really good cooking show or something like that. I love cooking. You know, I'd really listen into that. And that, you know, that's fascinating for me. It's a passion of mine. So if I had ADHD, I might not have a problem there, but I might have lots of other problems in really important areas of my life that don't hold my interest. You find people with ADHD tend to be, as a result, a bit more impulsive. They tend to look for bigger stimulus. And that makes sense, doesn't it? If they're looking, if they've got an underactive reward center, and they might find that they're into more extreme sports, like, you know, or more risk-taking behavior. So, I mean, I don't know, you know, if you want to ask any questions there, but I can go on to talk about really the Yeah, go on, John.
Yeah, so thanks very much. And that's really helpful and interesting. But it doesn't explain, if that's the case, why on earth are we seeing so much more of this? I mean, hasn't people's reward centres basically been always like this? Is it that we're just much more tuned into seeing it than it used to be? Is there something in the modern world which is accentuating this and making it worse? You know, what's going on with this huge rise in this problem?
So this is a really complex area. I think fundamentally it's really clear and important that we recognise this is a real thing. ADHD is as real as it gets. There's no doubt about it. It's such a clear biological mechanism that we've got very clear evidence. It's mostly genetic. And you can trace it in families, you can see it running through families. So there's no doubt that it exists and it's a thing. So from that perspective, it's always been there. And it's really important that we provide good levels of diagnosis and treatment for those who it affects. Now, whilst I completely and wholeheartedly support the idea of ADHD and the fact that it does exist, we have to also acknowledge that that as well as there being under diagnosis, there are lots of people with, you know, who don't have ADHD, who do have ADHD, who aren't being diagnosed. Overdiagnosis exists as well. Now, we do know that stimulants, which are the medications used in ADHD, have other benefits. So if you're a student revising for exams, I mean, I have pretty good levels of concentration. You know, I got through medical school and various other things that I've done in my life without stimulant medication. But I tell you what, if I did take stimulant medication, I would have been able to revise harder and for longer. They are cognitive enhancers. So there are that people that if you look at rates, for example, in Oxford University, the rates of students taking stimulant medications during finals are very high. And, you know, so there are people accessing these medications for the purpose of revising. That's clearly happening. And not just at Oxford University. I'm sure that's very, you know, global. The other benefit is they really help with weight loss. So, you know, we know that there's an obesity epidemic going on in most of the world. And if there's a clear way to help you lose weight, then get on stimulant medication. It completely kills your appetite. So there are people who do look for these medications for other reasons. So that's one. Another aspect is the fact that we are in an age where we have increasing diagnoses across the board. So rates of depression and anxiety are going up. You know, you look at rates of autistic spectrum disorder diagnosis, they're going up. And ADHD is going up, perhaps more than others. And I think there is a sense that we are looking to pathologize normal ranges of human experience. So I can tell you now, my 9 a.m. brain is razor sharp. My 11 p.m. brain is far from that. And it really struggles with concentration, attention, focus. It really struggles to remember things. And I will often be told something and go, oh, what were you talking about? What was I even talking about? I can't remember. So my brain has a quite a range there of ability through the day. And other people are reversed. So they're better in the evening and worse in the morning, sure. But people that exist on a spectrum, and whilst there's ADHD definitely exists, you could argue that people's willingness to tolerate difficulty in their life is reducing, and they are looking frequently to pathologize those difficulties. And certainly when you think about ADHD's breadth of difficulties, there are going to be some people who think, aha, I do struggle with memory sometimes, I do struggle with focus sometimes, maybe I've got ADHD. And perhaps they don't have ADHD, but they do have some of those problems. And what we're finding is both in professionals and the people looking for diagnoses are lowering the bar. And I think that is happening. So whilst ADHD is a clear condition, there is the sense of where should the bar be? You know, should it be okay for students to just take some stimulants when they're revising for finals? Why not? You know, some people might say that's okay. Other people say that's completely unethical. Some people might say, oh, well, look, if it's going to help you a bit, why not? There's not a really thin blue line between normality and ADHD here. There is an interpretive value that assessors like me will put on somebody. And whilst I see some people who clearly have ADHD will hugely benefit from treatment, other people, it's a bit more difficult to say, but they still will get these other benefits from ADHD. So you can see what this other aspect of increasing diagnosis is a concern.
Just on that diagnosis question then, is diagnosis purely done by just a kind of in-person assessment? You can't go and look in their brain and examine their dopamine levels and do any kind of quantifiable test. The diagnosis is purely done kind of what, assessing a kind of constellation of known symptoms and conversation and that kind of thing?
In the vast majority of ADHD assessments, is done clinically with a series of questions, and you know, you usually use a range of scales. But there is a new type of test coming out which is increasing in its use, which actually measures somebody's levels of distraction through eye movements and body movements and things when they're trying to do a task. And there's quite good validity for that. So you could, whilst that wouldn't be sufficient in itself to make the diagnosis of ADHD, it gives you a biological measure that can help support the diagnosis. But, you know, as again, I said, it depends what time of day. Somebody with ADHD might well pass that because they're in the bit of the day, or they're really engaged in the assessment and they're really worried about the assessment, so they're engaged in it. Where somebody else might be completely knackered and, you know, going through a difficult time, so they might be more distractible. So it's not by any means a really hard and fast measure, but it really helps support diagnosis.
Do you think there's anything in the environment that might be affecting this? Because I had a fascinating conversation with somebody who ran a nursery school for children and had been involved in it for decades. And she told me that they'd really noticed a change that previously, that it was particularly a nursery school for children with special needs. They had lots of children, things like cerebral palsy and learning difficulties and so on. And the nursery school used to be very much focused on activities, doing lots of things. And that recently they'd seen more children who were clearly acting out and so they'd had to have a sensory room. They had much more emphasis on time out and quiet spaces and reducing activity levels. And I thought that was just so interesting. And thinking again, what's changed? Were those children always there? And we're just much more aware of them? Or is it possible that there's actually some change going on in the population, particularly of young children?
Look, we all know that, you know, if you play computer games, it kind of kills your attention span. I know clinically that, you know, if you use things like crack and speed for many years, your attention span is very low, and you can develop sort of an ADHD like presentation. We certainly know that certain kids, when they have E numbers, they can behave very differently and in a disordered way. Hypothetically, it could be that there's things in the environment that do, you know, perhaps work to undermine people's or children's attention span. But the fact that I think in Maine, we know that this is a condition which, you know, big genome-wide studies have shown it's about 90% heritable. So it could be that 10% has something in, you know, that we're doing something in that 10%, but the most of ADHD is genetic. It's always been there. We're noticing it more. And I think probably a lot of the time, you know, we're increasingly scholastic, academic in our education, in our the job range that is there. You know, I mean, lots of people with ADHD who have found themselves in careers like, you know, landscape gardening or building, and they can work, you know, they can manage in there, but put them in an office, absolutely couldn't manage. And those, you know, people are doing more office work. So it's becoming more evident for these reasons.
And when someone has got a diagnosis, it is putting them on stimulant drugs the kind of immediate first line treatment? Or what are the different treatment options and how kind of successful are treatments typically?
So, yeah, after somebody's received a diagnosis, it's really important that they receive a good bit of psychoeducation. That means they really need to learn about ADHD. They need to look back in their lives and think, how has ADHD affected me? And they need to understand about managing inattention and hyperactivity. There are lots of things you can do. People with ADHD look for things like Red Bull and other, you know, energy drinks, and they look for often, you know, caffeine, and you know, these can often help in the moment, but overall make things worse. So there's lots of things behaviourally and through learning that can really help. But the first line treatments for ADHD are stimulant medications. So these are medications, you know, they are amphetamines, so otherwise known as speed, the drug speed. Amphetamines work to boost dopamine. They are given at much lower doses than used recreationally. They're also usually given in modified release preparations that last over the course of the day, sort of 8 to 10 hours. So people do not get a high, they do not get addicted. They take it or leave it. Most people with ADHD don't take it every day. They might leave it at the weekend because some of the effects are a bit unpleasant at times. But that is the first line treatment, yes. There are also non-stimulant treatments that exist, although these are much less effective, but they can be used where you might be concerned about concurrent drug use, or perhaps they've had side effects from the stimulants. But, and also psychological techniques can be supportive as well. The evidence for psychological input is nowhere near as good as stimulants, but I would say, and I often do advocate people to have both CBT and sometimes an ADHD coach is super helpful, particularly with people who are a bit older and have an adult ADHD diagnosis. They need an ADHD coach to really look at their week and unpick some of those ingrained patterns of behavior and emotional responses that have developed because they've developed with an ADHD brain that's had a significant impact.
And you mentioned there was a third reason that you thought prevalence was rising. Do you want to explain what that one was, or have you gone?
Well, this is a potential example of poor memory. I think it's about the societal level, sort of expectation of functioning. And I think there is a sense that at a societal level, if you are having any sort of struggle, then there must be something wrong with you. And that puts pressure on people. I think it's a subliminal thing. And I think we're seeing it if you look at mental health rates across the board. If people are struggling, they often reach for a pathology. And I think this is a societal, cultural pressure that is making people reach for overly concrete explanations or biological explanations for their difficulties, where their difficulties might well be located in a relational, psychological, social space. But obviously those domains are very difficult to engage with, and society doesn't often offer support in those areas particularly well. So people might reach for these biological explanations, which might be part of the answer, but they're often not all the answer.
So I'm really interested in this idea that society as a whole and the modern workplace is becoming more and more hostile to people who have this kind of tendency. You know, I've heard evolutionary explanations about, you know, why has this gene persisted in the population, and that it must have some evolutionary benefit. You can imagine, you know, to have people who are constantly scanning the environment, interested in new potentially threatening things, they're quite useful people to have around if you're in a hunter-gatherer community and looking out for predators and all that kind of stuff. But in a modern society, how do you flourish in a modern society? Basically, you have to be really good at sitting on your backside for hours on end, staring at a screen and focusing in a sedentary office-based environment. And it's almost as though we're creating a world in which a significant percentage of our population are just not going to fit in at all.
Absolutely. And even the ones who do fit in are neglecting huge aspects of their life, you know, engaging with nature and their physical bodies, you know, enjoying and using them healthily. So, yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that concern, John. And I'm concerned about just how much the use of computers and, online meetings really is, you know, a bit of an Achilles heel for these poor folk with ADHD. You know, so we're moving ever more into the use of these technologies that, you could say, why ADHD diagnosis pointing going up? Well, because we're having ever more jobs where the people's ADHD is becoming very obvious, and they're really struggling to engage. Whereas perhaps if it was more, if jobs were different, perhaps it wouldn't get noticed so much.
If you've ever struggled to fully understand the New Testament or explain your faith with confidence, you're not alone. That's exactly why Premier Insight exists and why your support matters right now. When you give today, we'll send you a special thank you gift. The New Testament You Never Knew Bible Study Guide by N.T. Wright. It will help you understand the context, meaning, and story of Scripture more clearly. And your support helps others do the same through programs like this. So please give your best gift today and request your copy. Just go to premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. Thank you for helping people engage God's word with wisdom and understanding.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
There was a fascinating investigation I came across last year. I'm sure you saw it, by the BBC here in the UK, where the reporter basically found that he could, rather than wait for a kind of official in-person NHS assessment of his supposed ADHD, which I think the waiting list was long or something like that, there was a number of online only private healthcare clinics who were offering these kind of online diagnosis. And in the end, you know, three separate clinics diagnosed their undercover reporter. And then when he went to the NHS in-person assessment, they showed he didn't have ADHD, but he was still able to access a lot of the drugs we were talking about. And the conclusion was, you know, there are so many people now as adults who are kind of trying to self-diagnose themselves and struggling to be filtered through the NHS state system, that this is kind of Wild West unregulated private clinics operating, which will kind of tell you what you want to hear, which is that, yes, you do have it, and yes, here are the drugs you're looking for. Did you have kind of concerns about that? Did you have any thoughts about that investigation?
Yeah. First of all, I think it was, you know, the program was good in the fact that it highlighted that some diagnostic centres for ADHD are not perhaps working with good scrutiny, good levels of scrutiny, and good levels of good quality assessments. Essentially, it's good to highlight that. But overall, I was deeply concerned about that programme for a number of reasons. Number one, it really undermined those people with ADHD. And we have lots of people with people who have ADHD, really significant struggles, now watching a program and thinking, oh, is my ADHD real? Does ADHD even exist? And goodness me, these people stigmatize themselves enough with all the problems they experience. Why? It was very irresponsible in its tone and in its content, and didn't give any voice at all to the fact that it's a legitimate diagnosis and people really, really struggle with ADHD. That's my number one concern about that. And I've met lots of people who've been really upset about watching that program. Number two, as in any area of medicine, if you go into private assessments, there are huge differences across the board. So, you know, if I had a sore hip, I might go and see one surgeon who tells me it's one thing. I see another surgeon, they tell me it's another thing. This is endemic across all specialties in medicine. It is not particular to mental health. It is not particular even to ADHD even. And to think that this is something which is only happening in ADHD is really, again, stigmatizing, disproportionate, and irresponsible. Thirdly, I think that, you know, the idea that you can take one person and give them, you know, one example of bad assessments and then generalize it across the whole of a field to delegitimize people like me, who I like to think deliver really good quality assessments, is also irresponsible and stigmatizing to the profession. Because I know, and the colleagues that I know and work with, provide really good, holistic, person-centered assessments with and deliver really, you know, clear diagnoses. And I think that the program and the person involved really did not give voice to the fact that there are very trustworthy professionals who are doing really good jobs and really changing, radically changing people's lives for the better by doing ADHD diagnoses. So in all, there was one useful thing that came out of it, which perhaps some unscrupulous ADHD assessment factories might look at their practice and up their game a bit. But overall, it was a piece of very irresponsible journalism.
Interesting. So you're not super concerned, as some people have been, about this kind of, or at least there are fears that people are kind of flocking to ADHD as a kind of soothing self-diagnosis. It makes me feel special. It's, you know, you see people talking about, oh, it's become fashionable online to say you have ADHD now. You think that's a bit of a myth. It's not really happening.
I think ADHD is real. It's a real problem. And people's lives get hugely, hugely changed, and the veil lifts from people's eyes when they've struggled for many years and they think, oh, why have I struggled? Oh, it's ADHD. Now, the one thing I would say, Tim, is that the thing about ADHD is it's got a range of quite disparate symptoms, ranging from procrastination through to distractibility, through to impulsivity, through emotional dysregulation, through to something called rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And there are many people who go, oh, I'm struggling a bit. And they latch onto a couple of these problems. And they jump into the fact that they might have ADHD, and they do self-diagnose with that. And what I'd say about ADHD diagnosis is really important. When I do it, you do a full mental health assessment first, because there's lots of reasons why ADHD mimics other mental health problems. And vice versa, mental health problems can mimic ADHD, and you've got to be really careful. These are Venn diagram overlaps. You know, somebody with anxiety has poor concentration, focus, distractibility, you know, and people, because ADHD is out there and it is the zeitgeist, people will self-diagnose inappropriately and wrongly. And I do see that frequently in clinic. It's not wrong that they do that. They're trying to help themselves. But actually, it's really important that they get accurate diagnosis. And the other thing I'd say is that when I read some of the stuff that's on the internet, people sort of say that they try and, if they've got an ADHD diagnosis, they try and over-explain all of their problems as ADHD. So I will often say, look, well, this bit of your problems is ADHD, but these bits of your problems are long-term psychological difficulties, because you didn't fit in at school, you felt left out at home, you've got low self-esteem, you do have an anger management problem, you know, you've got problems with impulsivity that do not lie completely in the ADHD camp. And you really need to manage their expectations down around stimulant treatment and say, this is about, you know, this is about your reward center, and this is about concentration and attention and attending to stimuli. It's in a pathological inability to be in the moment. That's what we're talking about. These wider issues, sometimes they're related, but let's not say that the ADHD treatment is a cure-all. And I think there is a tendency to think a bit like that.
Can I talk a bit about Panorama? Because it's we've got one professional journalist here and two doctors, both of whom feel that Panorama and other investigative journalism on medical topics is often incredibly irresponsible and damaging. I was taken over by a Panorama program, taken apart, which turned out to be an attack on the whole neonatology and the survival of premature babies. And so it's just interesting, isn't it? Tim, defend your profession.
Well, I wouldn't want to speak for all journalists everywhere as though we're some kind of guild and I'm the guild spokesperson. There is no doubt plenty of irresponsible journalism that takes place. I think medical journalism is a particular challenge because of the combination of the kind of scientific complexity that you're dealing with. You know, journalists like to tell clean, simple stories with beginning, middle and ends, direct causes and effects. And obviously medicine and science doesn't always work like that. And things are much more complicated that then can be kind of condensed down to a a 2 minute news bulletin or even a half an hour panorama investigation. So I think that's part of the issue for sure. But I think as well, journalists, or kind of the profession, often has a kind of strong and healthy skepticism against kind of gatekeepers and anything that might smack of kind of we know best elitism. And therefore, I think sometimes journalists and doctors rub up against each other because the doctors say, we're the experts, we've done the study.
Nothing to see here. Do what we say.
And journalists puts their antenna up and they're like, oh, hang on. The more someone tells me just to be quiet and stop worrying and we've got it all sorted, the more I want to ferret around and try and see if there's anything going on. And so I do sometimes wonder if there's a kind of almost like clash of cultures between the two professions, which makes them often kind of butt heads or talk past each other in unhelpful ways. But I haven't actually seen the particular Panorama program. I only read about it afterwards, so I wouldn't want to go any further than that.
I do think what medical journalists don't see is the impact of a high profile program like that. And as Daniel was saying, on a whole lot of ordinary people who have a diagnosis. In my case, it was often parents who'd been personally involved, and that seeing this kind of investigative journalism raised a whole lot of anxieties, concerns. You know, is this right, doctor? Are you really doing experiments on us all? You know, and so I think inevitably when you do a sort of expose on a medical issue. This impacts often thousands and thousands of people across the country. And I think in their desire to get a really good story and peak billing, you know, inevitably, you know, they're not really thinking about all the implications of what might happen to people who watch this program who are actually affected by this condition.
I think that's absolutely right. And often there is a competing demand between a really good story that's a polemic versus actually the nuanced, yes, there's a little bit of overdiagnosis, but there's also underdiagnosis, and we're increasingly recognising a group in our population who really do have a deficit that disables them in different ways. That's much less perhaps popcorny and attention grabby. So yeah, John, I think you're absolutely right. And it's a very nuanced debate, this ADHD, with lots of complexity. And so I couldn't agree more.
Shall we move on then, as we come towards the end, to our original listener's question, which was not just about ADHD, but as you kind of mentioned earlier, Daniel, there are people out there trying to access these stimulant drugs. Ritalin is a kind of common brand name I think people might have heard of, but there are others available because they are known to boost concentration and focus, and using it, whether it's for university finals or for preparing for a job interview. First question, you know, does it actually work? You know, if you or I were to take some, if I was to get my holds on one of these stimulants, would it make me have an incredible day at work and write really fast and get loads done? Is it that straightforward? Does it work for everyone like that?
Well, I'm sure you have incredible days most days, Tim, and work really hard. You know, so, you know, everything's relative. But yes, I would say that they are cognitive enhancers, and you will have improved concentration where, you know, might go and take a coffee break after an hour or so. You might not need that coffee break and you can steam through. But it wouldn't make huge amounts of difference to you. And generally what you find is that the negatives would outweigh the positives for you. So the fact that you don't get hungry, you have a few headaches, and you know, these other things ways it can affect you would outweigh the little benefit that you might get, unless perhaps you were studying for an exam or writing a report last minute and needing to stay up all night. I would say the more severe the ADHD and the bigger the problems, the bigger response you get, actually. And really, I've had people weeping in my assessment room. There's nothing like it when somebody has these medications and they come in and they just say, I've really seen life in a completely different way. I know what I've now been able to do things I haven't been able to do my whole life. And they completely, whilst they've thought they were a failure and a misfit, and they suddenly thought, wow, I it's ADHD and I understand it. Now I can begin to do things, and things they were had an aversion to, they now re-engage in a much more positive way. You know, if you look at the amount of ADHD rates in prison, you know, these are huge. I'm sure we could do things hugely positively for society by recognizing and treating people earlier so that they don't make impulsive decisions, dropping out of school, getting involved in drug use, you know, going down this route by actually spotting ADHD earlier. That's not to say that everyone with ADHD is on that trajectory, but there is a significant group of people that are. Really, there is nothing quite like, as a doctor, treating ADHD for seeing significant benefits. The effect sizes are very impressive if you look at treatment and response rates. Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess people listening might say, do you know what? I like the idea of enhancing my cognitive function. That sounds quite alluring. I haven't got ADHD, but I would love to be able to think faster and work harder. As a doctor and also as a Christian, do you think it is fundamentally unwise for us to kind of fiddle with our neurochemicals when there isn't a clinical reason to do so?
I would say that these stimulants should be used when you've identified a deficit, you've identified a condition that needs treating. The research studies are not there to measure exactly how much they've enhance normal people's cognitive functioning. Yeah, sure, they do to an extent, but there's also significant side effects with these. So I certainly would not advocate somebody without ADHD using these medications. No, I wouldn't. They don't give you a high, they don't change who you are, but no, I wouldn't advocate that.
But fast forward, you know, there's a lot of research going on here. Fast forward 5-10 years, and the next generation of cognitive enhancers is coming out. There are the clinical studies showing that this significantly improves cognitive abilities, and yet you know, side effects are relatively minor. And then the question comes, A, is this good for society? I mean, you know, already it sounds like if I'm studying for finals at Oxford University and I discover that most of my mates are on this and I'm not, I'm already putting myself at a disadvantage. But, you know, fast forward 5 or 10 years with the next generation of drugs, how are we going to think about this, both from a societal point of view, but also just thinking as a Christian about what's wise and what's good, what's a healthy way of treating my brain?
Should we put it in the tap water? The answer is no. The side effects are very significant. Some people really don't respond well to these and get very anxious. If you give them to people with anxiety disorders, it exacerbates anxiety. If you give it in an uncontrolled way, it can, you know, really spike people's blood pressure. There are, you know, significant problems with these drugs if not used very sensibly. And you know, I take incredible care when I'm titrating people on these medications, because the reactions can be really severe and people can really they can exacerbate acute deteriorations in mental health. I've seen that myself, and you know, so we need to be very careful with these meds. I mean, if you talk about it from an ethical perspective, should we just take things to enhance our brain capacity? Well, lots of us use caffeine, don't we? Lots of us, you know, try, you know, make sure we get a good night's sleep so we can think a bit better in the next day. Lots of us exercise because we know that improves concentration, you know, healthy body, healthy mind. So there's lots of other ways that we do work hard to improve our levels of concentration. But to take a substance which the ethical concern would be around really the potential harms that could be occurring here. Mm. Because in a sense, we're taking chemicals already to improve our concentration, and people do that regularly. So that's where my concerns are.
It's a really interesting medical phenomenon that I've seen time and time again, and that is that all the really powerful drugs, all the drugs that really do something, have serious side effects. It seems almost like a law of medicine, you know. And so the thing which makes me feel that homeopathic drugs don't really do very much is because the one thing that homeopathic doctors say is they're completely safe. They're completely without side effects. And that makes you rather...
It's because it's just water.
Exactly. So I'm not surprised to hear you say that these drugs, which can be life-transforming, also can carry very significant side effects. And that's the whole art, then, isn't it? The whole art of medicine is to try to make sure that you're getting the benefits with the minimum of the side effects.
Absolutely, yeah. And there really is quite a fine line there in ADHD of getting good treatment benefit and avoiding the adverse effects. That is an art, and you need to often juggle, you know, modified release versus immediate release versus the non-stimulant medications versus an ADHD coach and psychological therapy to really get that mix right for that person, as well as managing their expectations and acknowledging other comorbid mental health problems, because over 50% of people with ADHD have another mental health problem, which I think speaks into the sheer amount of stress that comes along with significant ADHD.
Well, can I tempt you onto a brief thought experiment, Daniel? Imagine we lived in a world where there was a stimulant drug that actually didn't genuinely clinically had no medical side effects, but it did still have this cognitive enhancing effects. In this imaginary world, which obviously scientifically can't exist, but imagine it does, would you feel comfortable with people, let's say Christians, saying, why wouldn't I want a bit of extra concentration if there are genuinely no medical harmful side effects? Or do you say, some people would say, hang on, that's playing God. We should just accept our brains as God made them and live with them in all their limitations. Where would you fall on that spectrum?
I don't think it's a, you can say, you know, I'm a Christian, therefore yes or therefore no. I think there's going to be a variety of reasonable responses here. You know, so for example, you know, non-ADHD US pilots use these kind of medications to sustain their attention when they're doing long flights, you know, the US Air Force, when they're doing long night flights, to ensure their attention. So most people would argue, well, that's actually quite a good thing. And maybe, you know, we don't want them falling asleep with a nuclear warhead on their jet, crashing into the, who knows where. You know, we use alcohol to lubricate social situations, don't we? And I think some Christians have a problem with that. Some Christians actually really enjoy that social lubrication and the fact that it, you know, loosens their, you know, social anxiety up a bit, so that they can really engage positively in a good sense. But done too much, we all know with alcohol where that goes. So I think there's a variety of, reasonable Christian responses here. And that probably depends on the context and the motivation for why you're wanting this. And so, for example, if I'm just taking these cognitive enhancers in order that I can do better than Mr. Bloggs over there, well, is that a Christian motivation? You know, whereas actually if the motivation is, you know, I'm doing this because if I don't manage to get this report in, I'll lose my job and then I won't be able to support my family. Well, and I love my family and care for them, and I'm not going to get another job. Well, you might say that that's a much more reasonable context to be getting some support. However, that person might have got into that the situation is a different question altogether. But, you know, I would say it's the motivation behind it, the heart that is looking to be serving and caring and loving the people around them and themselves in a godly way. And sometimes a bit of cognitive enhancing might be a reasonable fit in that picture. But otherwise, in lots of other circumstances, it might be a very selfish thing to do.
Yeah, I really identify with that. And I think it's such a fascinating thing about a Christian understanding of morality, you know, this idea that God looks at the heart. In other words, it's not the superficial externals, that in order to interpret an act from a moral point of view, you've really got to look at the heart. You've got to look at the deeper levels of what the intention was, what was the context, and I think that applies to all morality, you know. And this is the problem with types of moral reasoning, you know, which just look on the surface. Was this good? Was this bad? You know, did this increase pleasure, the maximum amount of pleasure in the world? Did this increase more pain? the Christian understanding of morality is much more nuanced, and it's much more about who we are inside and what we're aiming to achieve. And the Lord looks on the heart. And that's also why we don't judge, isn't it? We can't judge another in the end, because we don't see their heart. We don't know what was happening, what were they were intending to do.
Absolutely. And following on from that, you know, the people that I see, you know, coming to me for an ADHD diagnosis, you know, their heart's usually in the right place. They're usually going, look, doc, I've got these problems. How can you help me? Now, there are some people who want to inhabit a label a bit too much, but perhaps that's because they're just trying to find an answer to their problems. And all they need is a really good explanation, a really good understanding of saying, well, it's not ADHD, but this is how to understand your problems. Or sometimes you say it is ADHD and, or sometimes you say, yes, you're right, this is ADHD, you really need support. They come from a very good space. They, you know, to think that people, the majority of people are coming with some sort of malingering sense of self-promotion is really false. Yeah, just we're very good at being very anti-new things and being very cautious. And there's a reason why we might be a bit sceptical. But, you know, you're seeing new things around. You know, it's 20, 30 years ago, people were going, oh, does mental health or mental illness exist? Is it a real thing? And blinking heck, do we all know that, yeah, mental illness is real. You know, we've struggled with these things, goodness me. And ADHD, yes, it's been a bit behind things like depression and bipolar and schizophrenia. Yes, it has. But that doesn't mean it's any less of a real thing. And just because we're learning new things doesn't mean that it's not real. And we need to let go of our cynicism and acknowledge that there are deficits we're learning about in the brain, the most complex thing in the known universe, that actually can really help and support people with genuine struggles.
We've talked a lot on this podcast before about how a lot of Christians have this kind of innate, sometimes called a kind of bioconservatism, that just says, you know, don't want to go there, let's not touch that, when it comes to lots of different things, whether it's about reproductive technology or neuroscience or anything else. There's this kind of sense that the most Christian thing is probably just to have nothing to do with it and leave it all alone and just stick with what we've got. And I think when we discuss these topics, we're often finding actually God calls us into a much more difficult posture, which is about, well, actually, we don't just have these blanket black and white rules that guide us. We have to exercise discernment and grow in wisdom and think these things through and do the work to apply scripture and Christian tradition and ethical principles time after time after time, rather than just falling back on a kind of pro forma formulaic approach to medical ethics or bioethics. So I suspect this is another one of those cases where, as you've both been saying, you can't just come up with a simple black and white rule that guides us how to think about these things, but actually we're going to have to dig in deep and do the research, read the studies, listen to the experts, listen to the patients, and think, what is God calling us to do and say and act in this particular moment right here and now, which is more difficult, but probably, I think, more fruitful, more faithful in the long run. Why
wise words, Tim. Wise words, particularly from a journalist. I mean, you know, yeah.
Amazing. Well, before we fall off the wagon here, let's call it a quits. Thanks so much, Daniel, for sharing with us about your experiences and your expertise on this. It's been a really interesting conversation. I've learned a lot. I hope you guys listening have too. As always, don't forget to keep on sending in your questions. This whole episode came about because of a fascinating question from a listener. So thank you to Karen for sending that in. But yeah, if you've got any other questions or feedback or thoughts or disagreements, you can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we will be back with another episode next week. And until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.